Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to this abandoned building where I'm going to do my best to do an episode of The Damage Report, because that is my literal contractual obligation. That's the obligation. My pleasure, my privilege is to do the show with Jason Carter, who returns right now. How's it going, Jason?
It's going great. Wow, privilege. On this first day of October, I feel so privileged to be back here with you as well, John. Good to see you. Good to see you back in the studio. How does it feel to be back at the old stomping grounds? It's been like 5 years.
I like it. It was a rough half decade. It feels good to not be just sitting in this one chair at home for 6 months straight. But it is sort of bittersweet that nobody else is here. Like it feels like I survived the apocalypse and now I'm just like effectively a roach scavenging like through what's left. That feels a little bit weird. You look like you're in some sort of utopia right now, actually.
Yes, that is the magic of Skype. I'm here in Miami, and you know, it's normally on the first day of October, where I'm from Albuquerque, New Mexico, there it's cold, it's brisk, it's chilly, it's sweater weather. No, definitely not happening here in the 305. It's 85 degrees outside. What's going on? But so I give the utopia to everyone across the country that's dealing with weather that's not so favorable.
Yeah, the weather looks nice. I don't want the heat though. It's been a little bit too hot. And much of our state is actually on fire right now. So I'm gonna avoid any of that. By the way, I'm looking at the YouTube chat right now, and there's a lot of love for Jason returning. Before the show, we were talking about superhero movies and sort of one version of the golden age of superhero movies. My instinct is to just make that the hour like the last time Jason was on, but I guess we do have news to talk about quite a bit, actually, because we're gonna be talking about the FBI, right-wing terror groups, the cost of cancer drugs. We're gonna get a little bit into the Supreme Court battle, among other things, a lot that we're gonna be talking about. And if you are one of the several thousand already watching, whether on YouTube or Twitch or literally anywhere, there's gotta be something you can do to let people know that we're active. Likes, subscribes, shares, bells, I don't know what they have. You discover it and then let me know. And then that way we'll have a nice big crowd to help get us through what's probably gonna be a very difficult month coming up. Yes. And as we go, if you send us in, you know, chats and super chats and tweets and stuff like that, Jason and I will be responding to that as well. So Jason, with that, you wanna do some news?
Let's do some news, let's go for it.
We will. Yesterday, by the way, was basically all debate. It's not gonna be all debate, but just bear with me for a second. Donald Trump swears that he won that debate. I guess it was, technically it was a debate. With him tweeting this morning, I won the debate big based on compilation of polls, etc. Thank you. No, you didn't. There's no compilation of polls. I don't know what you're talking about. I saw one Telemundo Twitter poll where he had won. That's probably what he's referring to, Jason, the compilation of that Telemundo Twitter poll. But no, he didn't. He doesn't think that, but he has to say it. This is his brand. I'm the biggest, I'm the best, I won, even though he knows he didn't.
He unequivocally did not win that debate. You know, I had tweeted out, John, that watching the debate was the best reality TV I had seen in forever. It was like one of those Real Housewives of Miami or whatever city reunions where they just throw water on each other and it's just like, you did this. It was terrible. It was the most gross display of immaturity that two grown men could ever have on national television. And I will give it to Biden, who for whatever it's worth, found a loophole by one, for the first what, hour, not even looking at Trump, but two, connecting with the American people and saying, I'm here for you, because he realized that was the only strategy he could take that would be favorable during that whole thing. Because even watching it was like, what is happening? And you wanted to walk away with something. I know we're not gonna talk about the debate much, but for myself, this is the first time I've actually been able to talk about it publicly. You wanted to walk away with actionable items from either candidate, right? Because historically, that's what the debate yields. Is this is what they plan to do, but it got very personal, got very petty. The petty copter was flying low, guys. Like, it was just petty everywhere. And so for Trump to come out and say, I won the debate, you may have won over talking and talking over. Now Chris Wallace, who, kudos to him for checking the president of the United States and saying, look, homie, zip it. But as far as coming out of anything that was coming out ahead with anything positive or just actionable or just good, no, Trump, that's not what happened. So in my own honest opinion, no one won the debate. Sure enough, Trump didn't win it.
Yeah. Well, I don't give Chris Wallace as many kudos as you do, but it was a difficult job. I will admit that. And I will say this. It's one thing for Trump to tweet that he won. Nobody's surprised by that. As I said, it's his brand. He's always gonna claim that he won. But the thing is, if we wanna understand what he really thinks happens, we can't, because we're not psychic. But we can go one step closer to what he really thinks, which is gonna be revealed in this clip with Dana Bash reporting on what Trump associates are saying he's saying about the debate behind closed doors.
Well, I'm told from a source familiar with the president's thinking that in private conversations, he is insisting that he did well, that he had a great night. And when it is suggested to him strongly that he did not have a great night, that he was too aggressive, that he interrupted too much, that he is surprised to hear that pushback. What I'm told is that the sort of feeling is that once the president digests his steady diet of cable news that he, you know, he always does, that it is going to hit him likely in the next day or so, that he did in fact interrupt too much, that he did in fact have a bad night, like everybody around him believes that he did.
But wait, do they really believe that? Because I'm sorry, but I started to interrupt, but I mean, all the mouthpieces who have been flooding the airwaves, you know, Peter Navarro and the others, they've all been parroting both the style and substance of what the president said.
That's true. But the analogy that was given to me was, remember when the president suggested that injecting or digesting bleach would help with coronavirus, and he couldn't believe that people actually thought that was a big deal. After a day or two, he got that was a big embarrassment.
John, so first of all, can we go a big shout out to the subtle shade of Anderson Cooper? I always live for the shade of Anderson Cooper, because it just comes like, wait, did he just shade somebody again? Kudos to Anderson. But to Dana's point about the bleach and Trump finally, and you know, days later realizing, wait a minute, that wasn't my best turn. It's shocking for someone who, look, Trump is a smart man. Business-wise, he's been successful. He's not an idiot. He's not stupid. Maybe some of the things he does are idiotic, but I would love to think that he does have a brain underneath that horrible hairdo. How can you not watch that back and have trusted advisors who guarantee trusted advisors, which are your family, telling you, dad, husband, whoever, boss, that was a bad look. And any person with any kind of respect for themselves professionally can look at that and be like, what just happened? Especially, and then when you're in it, be like, what's going on? Mm-hmm. So for Trump not to know that, or for him to think that was his best night for this campaign, kicking off this campaign, you know, maybe there's an antidepressant he can take, maybe there's some therapy he can engage in or something that'll help him bring him back to reality, because that was not it. It was not the move. Mm.
Yeah, I would say that this is another area where if you have no respect for or understanding of or curiosity about science, you are going to lead a worse life. As an analogy, I'm in a writing group with a couple of people. We write fantasy novels and we go back and forth. And sometimes one of us will have an idea and we'll put it in our book. And the other people in the group are like, you need to change that. But they don't want to. They like that idea. In that case, though, we can't turn to Gallup polling or CBS News that shows that no, it's actually a bad idea. If Trump could use that, he could look at the instant polls from CNN and CBS News and show that he definitely lost the debate. And he could develop based on that. But he doesn't trust any of that. So he continues on believing he's right when he's clearly wrong. And while we had that immediate polling, now we have the first of, I would argue, a more important sort of polling coming out. I saw this, David Dole had tweeted about it. Change polls and CNBC had a new national post-debate poll. So this is after the debate. Biden is up 54 to 41, a 13-point lead. That same poll last week had him up 9. So that's a 4-point jump. It's just one poll. It isn't everything. Mm-hmm. But it certainly doesn't look like Biden got destroyed by Donald Trump in that debate.
He didn't. And if you watch, I mean, just and going back to just watching it, any person that millions of people tune in to watch this because they have strong opinions on what's happening in our country in regards to politics. And anyone watching that, even if you were not politically inclined or had a political interest, anyone watching that could still see that level of bad communication is just that, bad communication. And when you argue or when you're trying to get a point across, there's a nuance and a way of doing that. And I stand by it. I just felt like it was a personal attack after personal attack after personal attack, that in a time where people, if Trump really cared about the American people and the public, he would have approached that in a way that was like, okay, here's the plan of how to make America great again. I was in Key Largo, Florida over the weekend, and I kid you not, every other house had a Trump Pence making good on promises and all these things that have been his slogan now for this campaign. So it's like, great, you have the world stage to tell us how you're going to do that, but yet you chose to pivot and be, again, petty. Good for Biden. I know you said that I gave Biden way more kudos than I should have, but
Chris Wallace.
I'm sorry, Chris Wallace, right. But even Biden, people were flaming Biden for him kind of, I don't know, surrendering to the pettiness as well as Trump. But at least Biden had a sense of sincerity of why he was there and what he wanted to get across, fighting off the constant interruption from Trump. And when he turned to the camera and stared straight down the barrel and said, American people this, here's that, trying to connect with us, I thought that was his best weapon of staying alive in what was a dumpster fire of a debate. So polls aside, Trump to me was the biggest loser. The biggest loser in the history of debate.
Out of three losers. I agree. Talking directly to the audience, I think is a good tactic. It plays into his like, hey, I at least have a heart thing.
Right.
But also, if your opponent is constantly interrupting you, it doesn't look as bad if they're interrupting you attacking them.
Right.
But if they're interrupting you trying to appeal to the American people, that might look worse.
Right.
But I do have a little bit of good news. So let's transition to that now. I think about 5 minutes into that debate, America, which hasn't been able to agree on anything for a long time, most people could agree on one thing. They got to start cutting the mics, man. This is a mess. And apparently, that might actually happen. Because while Chris Wallace apparently couldn't have dreamt that it would go off the tracks the way it did, this is who Trump is, and he's not going to be any better next time. We know that now. So the commission that oversees the general election presidential debate said on Wednesday, it's going to be making changes to the format of the remaining two debates, because we do have to go through two more of these. One key change it plans to implement, cutting off the microphones of President Trump and Joe Biden if they break the rules, according to a source familiar with the commission's deliberations. Now, they haven't said they're going to do that, but they're saying that is very much in play as a potential solution. So Jason, are you more excited for the next one? What do you think about that change if they do it?
I think it's a definite needed change. I think that should have always been something they could have engaged in during these debates when, as Christopher Wallace says, they go off the rails, because it's not about them, it's about what they're saying to the American people. I'm excited for this Pence-Harris debate, because here you have a woman of color going up against the vice president, and it's never before have we seen this. We've seen this kind of dynamic, right? But if it gets heated, I don't want them. I don't want them cutting off people for the sake of, which I don't think they'll do, but for the sake of just like being super cautious, right? I think you should be organic with it and let things play out. I think had Trump and Biden's debate been a little bit more not as heated, we could have still muddled through all the attacks and all the muddiness and still got something away from that. So for them to be able to say, okay, we can do this, I don't think it should be potentially. I think they should be like, yes, this will happen. If you go left, we are going to cut your mics like you've talked too much at the Oscars. Like, no, that's not what we're doing. they should be able to have that power and engage that power and use that power whenever necessary. So I think, but that should have been in place the whole time. That should have happened years ago.
Yeah. I would like to make a prediction, sort of. I know that Trump already responded to this when it was a little bit less certain and said that it's a bad thing, they shouldn't do it. And I bet a lot of Trump supporters hearing that, and if they actually do it, will think, well, that's terrible, let him speak, let Trump be Trump. But the thing is, I think if they do this, that actually could help Trump. Not help him to do what he wants to do, but help him to actually look better, because it didn't help him to interrupt, it didn't. And I think it made Biden a more sympathetic figure. I think, and this isn't just me, some people on Fox News yesterday were saying, Trump, you need to let Biden talk because he'll look bad, he'll stumble or whatever. And I don't know for sure that that's true, but it kind of feels like the only thing that could help Trump at this point. And so I know he's gonna reflexively hate this change, but I think it might give him the best chance of at least pulling even in these debates. If Biden has to speak and all of that, maybe he looks bad or like he can't, you know, like he's not focusing on the right things. I don't know. I think that it could end up helping Trump though.
What would also help Trump is someone that works for him to help him with his body mechanics. That finger thing he does, drives me insane. It's like, dude, that
I hate it.
It's this one. Like, let me say, no, I can't even begin to do his voice. I'm a terrible Trump.
No, person. Do it.
I can't do it. I'm not gonna go there. I'm not gonna do it. But I will say this needs to stop. It's the placement of all the other, and it's the finger, it's everything. And the way he purses his lips, like he reminds me of Miranda Priestly from The Devil Wears Prada when she purses her lips and goes. Kills me. It's like watching John Mayer sing. He looks like he has like this pig face. It's just I'll just listen to you and not look at you. You are to be heard, not seen.
Oh my God. Yeah, I haven't talked about this in probably a year, but multiple times since Trump became a thing. I will just say, I get that I'm not gonna be able to convince the right that Trump isn't a strong guy, a tough guy, an alpha male or whatever, because they think weakness is strength, ignorance is intelligence, all of that. But I will just say, as an outsider, if you are trying to project raw masculinity, the little pokes, you're gonna like that. Like that to me, nobody does it. It's like, it's just Trump that does that. And it just looks so weak and whiny and pathetic. But whatever, I can't convince them that being a real man isn't about being as weak and whiny as possible, because they all seem to have landed on that together.
That you can't. There's no proselytizing those people. You know what? And just to wrap up the segment, when I watched Trump speak, I think he'd be absolutely more effective if he was a little bit more stoic and would it's almost as if he comes with this game plan of theatrics, right? Like, here's how I'm gonna act, here's the character I'm playing today, right? And then you think about the team of people that he has to help him be effective and to do this job, because it takes a village to be the president of the United States. Advisors, you have a whole bevy and gaggle of ass kissers that make sure that you look great, because being president is also, you're a celebrity. Really, when you're making appearances on Jimmy Kimmel and Jimmy Fallon, and you're in all these places that are in the pop culture zeitgeist, you're a celebrity, right? So you have people who make sure that image translates to wherever you go. I don't understand why the people that work for him aren't getting him together and like, bro, like, let's do some media training. Let's figure this out, because I think he does have something he does have something, and before he became president, we loved that something in The Apprentice. We loved that something about him that kept us wanting to watch him and to engage with him in some capacity. So now that he's the president of the United States, it's like, okay, well, where is that? And I just feel like it's just gone out the window, and the people that work for him are either they're secretly trying to sabotage him, or they just don't care, or he just, as we've seen, just doesn't care to listen. And I think with the debate,
I think it's the third one.
Right, yeah, he just does not. He's so far up his ass. Can I say that on TYT? That
I think so.
There's no turning back. There's no turning back.
Yeah. Yeah, nobody's perfect. Everybody needs to be open to, especially if you are blessed enough to have 1,000 people working for you.
Right.
Maybe listen to them occasionally. I don't know.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of On the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
We all get at this point that pharmaceutical companies deciding to unilaterally, without any reason, raise the price of medication is really more about their own financial interest than anything having to do with our good health. But it can be a bit abstract. It's not going to be in the video you're about to see, though, because Representative Katie Porter had the CEO of Celgene in, and she very clearly, very simply explained the connection between his own personal financial interest and the way they manipulate the price of pharmaceuticals.
Do you know what this number is? Does it ring any bells?
I think you're referring to my compensation in some way.
In some way, this was your compensation in 2017 for being CEO of Celgene. And that's a lot of money. It's 200 times the average American's income and 360 times what the average senior gets on Social Security. Now, of that 13 million, about 2.1 million came from your company hitting yearly earning targets. And more than half of the bonus formula was based on those targets. Any increase in the price of Revlimid would also increase your bonus by increasing earnings. Isn't that right, Mr. Ellis?
If revenues increased and expenses did not, then earnings would be enhanced.
Thank you. Mr. Ellis, in fact, the Oversight Committee found that if you hadn't increased the price of Revlimid, you wouldn't have gotten your bonus. Mr. Ellis, do you know how much you personally received in bonuses over the last two years, just because Celgene raised the price of this one drug, Revlimid?
I receive very generous compensation, but I don't know the exact number that you're referring to.
In fact, you personally received $500,000 personally just by tripling the price of Revlimid. So to recap here, the drug didn't get any better. The cancer patients didn't get any better. You just got better at making money. You just refined your skills at price gouging. And to be clear, the taxpayers spent $3.3 billion on Revlimid.
Okay, There's so much that's so great. Like, as you pointed out, she's like, let me look at these numbers. You know what? Actually, let me put on my glasses and look at these insane numbers I just sketched out here. The way she's like, do you know how much you personally earned? I'm not going to wait for you to say it. I'm just going to write it in right here. Ah, she was so prepared, so smooth.
So smooth. I liken, first of all, she's like the Bob Ross of the courtroom. Secondly, I liken that whiteboard to Thor's hammer Mjolnir. It's just like the powers it wields, man, because you can't deny the visual proof here. I want to create a fragrance that makes me a badass called Badass by Katie Porter, pour home, just spray it on, because she comes hard and she comes with facts, and she's like this bastion of bravery and compassion for people. And God, she just unapologetically is not afraid to go after people and say, here are the facts, here's what you need to know, and call them out publicly and hold them accountable. Hold them accountable. And I think accountability is something that a lot of people are afraid of. I think accountability is something that's lacking. And it's not like she's one of these people, John, that just screams. You know, on social media, people are very loud and they claim to have facts. They claim to have all the knowledge. They claim to have done the research. But when you really strip it away, they don't. They're just regurgitating things that aren't vetted, right? Katie Porter has done her research extensively. So you know when she's on that stand talking to someone and really grilling them, she has the facts that are really gonna get the point across. And this was just one, this was great. This is great entertainment. Thank you so much for those moments in television. And secondly, I think that we need more of that. We need more of that to hold people accountable. And everyone needs a whiteboard with a dry erase marker. Much like cell phones have become a weapon to save your life in 2020. Whiteboards and dry erase markers are doing the same.
You know, Jason, to tie together this with what we were talking about before, as you were saying, everyone needs a whiteboard. I have a stand up whiteboard right near here that I almost got up and pulled over. But then I realized that I had sketched out some of the plot points of my fantasy novel. So I decided I'm not going to do that, actually. So anyway, plus I love the idea of it as Mjolnir, that she finishes up that grilling of the CEO. She puts it down, she goes away. And then Louis Gohmert comes up. And he craps his pants trying and failing to lift it. That's what I imagine.
100%.
But anyway, she's great. Like, you know, I don't think that she gets enough credit. Obviously, there's, you know, there are these huge figures like AOC and Ilhan Omar and all that are amazing as well and get all the attention. Katie Porter is really good though. Like, she does the stuff where it really counts. Not necessarily always in public. She's not as good on social media, obviously, but we just need more of that. And yeah. Great work.
John, I think she doesn't get, you know, you mentioned AOC and the other women. I think, you know, we talked about this before too, about, you know, the power of social media and how Gen Z millennials, that's how they communicate. If you can engage, if you are a public figure or a political figure or whatever, that you want to get a message out and you know how to engage millennials, younger millennials and Gen Z, you're gonna be a lot more effective because that's where they're living, is on social media. They love a good tweet. They love a salacious tweet, or they love a very informed tweet. And Katie Porter is probably, she's a little old school, I'm sure. And she probably feels like, I don't have time for that. Let's just get down to the meat and potatoes of it all and just keep it pushing. She definitely loves to reclaim her time. She will reclaim her time over and over and over again, as she should. But we need to protect her at all costs. She's a national treasure.
Yeah, 100%. By the way, can I skip in the graphics to this tweet from YS, who says that moment you're testifying in front of Congress, but then see Katie Porter bring out the whiteboard.
Seriously.
It's just great. And by the way, like, I'm so glad, I believe it was Sophie that produced this story. Apologies if I'm wrong there. But I want to bring up this next tweet, because the tweet just says it did not end well for a big pharma exec when Representative Katie Porter pulled out her whiteboard. But that's not the important part of the tweet. But the important part of the tweet is, and Sophie noticed it, is that's the Daily Caller saying that, because nobody, like, I get there's people in the House and in the Senate that want to protect people like that CEO and protect their right to gouge people. And if that means that you can't afford the cancer drug that they're doubling or tripling the price of, or if your insulin is going to bankrupt you, they don't care. They're going to protect those people. But the vast majority of people don't feel that way. And they want to see these sorts of CEOs grilled this viciously as often as possible. That's the power of what we just saw there from Katie Porter. Now, imagine that display as the philosophy behind a presidential run or something like that, actually taking it to these people that have gotten away with basically effectively murder. That's not just appealing to crazy lefties like me. That's not just crazy to Democrats, or that's not just appealing to Democrats. It's appealing to a lot of people. And so that's why, again, all the power in the world, all the credit to the world to Katie Porter there.
What if Katie Porter's like, what if that's her power? We talk about mutants a lot on this show. What if that's Katie, like, what if she's a mutant? That's her power. Because she, like, you know, or that's her shtick. She knows that she, maybe she is savvy on social media. Maybe she knows that's what people expect from her. Maybe behind closed doors, she's like this docile, like just very like, she watches, I don't know, she reads Daniel Steele novels and is just very like, still, drinks tea. Goes for long walks in the beach, you know, but then she like raw. She's like Bruce Banner becomes the Hulk, like raw. I'm Katie Porter. Oh, my whiteboard. Oh.
Did you see the Social Dilemma, the documentary?
I started watching it, John, and here's the deal with that. As someone who spent a lot of time on Instagram, it was like shining a mirror and a light on my existence. I just wasn't ready for it.
okay. Anyway, well then I'll avoid the analogy.
No, what are you gonna say? Yeah. No, what? Tell me.
Well, I was just gonna say they have these like sort of anthropomorphized algorithms that are like, yeah, we got them to click on that. Like right. Maybe she is badass on social media, not in terms of tweeting something, but she sees us going viral and she's just like,
She probably, the team that Trump should have, Katie Porter probably has a team in California that's like, all right, Katie, this is what we're doing today. The algorithms show, the numbers show that if you say reclaiming my time 5 times, you're gonna get 500,000 more retweets than if you say it 3 times. So try to go for that. Also bring down the tone. How about I'm reclaiming my time versus I'm reclaiming my time. Try things differently this time. Let's see how that works for you. Let us know how that goes. That's the conversation she has with her intern.
Listen to your team. Just listen to your team.
Yeah.
Okay. With that was fun. Unfortunately, some of the news we're going to be talking about not necessarily quite so positive. So why don't we get into that? More great reporting from friend of the show Ken Klippenstein on the FBI's very recent document warning the country. And more importantly, the government, if it cared to pay attention, about the threat over the next few months of right-wing terror attacks, especially during an apparent hot zone leading up to inauguration. So understand this is gonna come as a shock to someone like Donald Trump, who said at the debate, almost everything I see is from the left wing, not the right wing. But I'll tell you what, somebody's gotta do something about Antifa and the left, because this is not a right wing problem, this is a left wing problem. Well, that's what he says. The FBI apparently says something different. So in documentation exclusively obtained by The Nation and Ken Klippenstein titled, Boogaloo adherents likely increasing anti-government violent rhetoric and activities, increasing domestic violence extremist threat in the FBI Dallas area of responsibility. That's the title, by the way. It really tells the story by itself. It warns of the threat posed by those Boogaloo boys that have already committed acts of violence around the country. Draws on a wide array of intelligence sources, making specific mention of human sources, sort of implying that the FBI might have people embedded inside of the Boogaloo boys. And basically, we're not gonna read the entire thing, but over the next 3 months, the FBI Dallas office judges that continuing up until inauguration, Boogaloo adherents likely will expand their influence in that area of responsibility, sort of playing on existing anti-government or anti-authority violent extremists, the perceived government overreach having to do with COVID-19 and things like that. And that they will continue to try to take peaceful protests and turn them into sort of spark acts of violence. So very important that everybody know about this, because this isn't something that you heard at the debate. You heard that it's all the left wing or whatever, but according to the FBI, that is not what they're worried about over the next few months.
Right. Well, and you know, the proof's in the pudding. I mean, these people have already historically have committed acts of violence, and they have strong feelings in regards to what's happening in our country. I'm not surprised by this. Going back to what Trump said about it's the left being the problem here, I feel, and I could be wrong, this is my own opinion, but you know, I feel like the left has been very reactionary as to what has been to actions that come before the actions that we have taken in regards to the state of our country, Black Lives Matter, you name it, everything that we have been through in the last 4 years, I feel like has been a reaction to an action taken against us. I wouldn't be surprised if we see an uptick in more. Not just with groups like this, but in other parts of the country, pockets of the country with groups doing and trying to cause trouble and enact violence and incite hate leading up to the election and also leading up to the inauguration in January, because it's like we're at a fever pitch now, right? It's like Charlottesville and all these things that have been like the precursors. I say time and time again, winter's coming. I'm fearful for something very dire to happen within the next 90 days. And again, that's just me going down the rabbit hole of my crazy mind. But if the FBI is saying, and the FBI, look, they're a governmental agency. I'm sure they have informants. We've seen movies where there's many a movie about where the FBI has informants in places to infiltrate these negative groups and to infiltrate the enemy and espionage and all that. But I wouldn't put it past them to have informants that are feeding them info that is actually accurate. That is accurate.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah. Who knows? Who knows, man?
This year, as people know from past appearances of yours on the show, I have a newfound respect for your spider sense about danger, because you got the pandemic a lot better than I did before it really hit the US. But yeah, I'm very worried about this. I would say, look, everybody needs to go about their lives, and you especially need to vote, but you also should be on your guard.
Yeah.
Over the next few months, according to this report, because they're going to look to inspire something, whether it's committing acts of terror themselves or doing this sort of thing that I'm going to describe. So this summer, one boogaloo, Stephen Carrillo, is alleged to have killed two law enforcement officers in Northern California. True to the group's desire to hasten the next civil war, Carrillo is alleged to have killed the law enforcement officers at an otherwise peaceful demonstration with a silenced machine gun in hopes of provoking retaliation from the police against the demonstrators. Later in September, two other Boogaloo members were arrested and charged with providing material support to Hamas. So they're working with Hamas against the US government and law enforcement. Which always it boggles my mind that the law enforcement so loves the right wing like this when they're perfectly willing to kill them to start something. But that's what they're doing. It's not that they just go there to try to kill a protester. They go there to attack cops so that the cops will crack down on the protesters and possibly kill them. This is how insidious it is. So just bear that in mind.
Also, civil war, a civil war, right? Saying that the next civil war will be a race war. In my 41 years on this planet, John, I've never been involved in a civil war. I mean, there's never been talks of another civil war. But to hear that, and that's not the first time I've heard someone talk about another civil war in regards to where we're going in the future in this country. It's brutally frightening. And you mentioned insidious, right? So you're going to murder the people you support. Like, no, there's no regard for human life. We're going to murder a cop. That the best plan you have is to murder a cop. In order to hurt somebody, in order to hurt the little people, but murder the person who's supporting you, right? That kind of crazy mentality is what's frightening, because people that you have to be afraid of people who have nothing to lose, and to have that mentality clearly demonstrates that they have nothing to lose, right? They have nothing to lose and have no regard for human life. So to your point, you absolutely have to be on your guard. In 2020, and in so many different ways, John, and so many different beyond violence, COVID, financial. It's like the evils of the world are strong. They're out and they're active.
Yeah. Yeah, you're 100% right. And really fast, I want to thank again Ken Klippenstein. He published this story yesterday on The Nation, and the report was published on the 29th. So I guess they leaked it to him literally as they were publishing it. Like, he got it instantly. And so he apparently has a lot of sources. He probably doesn't even need any more. But if you do work for the government, if you are in one of these organizations and you want to help him out, ask Ken Klippenstein if leaking is right for you. You can text him at the number you're seeing on the screen, 202-510-1268 via Signal now. He breaks more stories than the vast majority of reporters, and somehow isn't a big political media figure. I don't understand it. He does great work. He deserves way more credit than he currently gets. But inevitably, his star is on the rise. So you heard it here first, and you heard about the FBI first from him. Immediately after Kyle Rittenhouse took a gun he never should have had and crossed a border he never should have crossed to go to Kenosha to murder multiple protesters inside of the DHS, talking points started to be circulated about how they should address that mass killing. Federal law enforcement officials were apparently directed to make public comments sympathetic to Kyle Rittenhouse. In preparing Homeland Security's officials for questions about Rittenhouse from the media, a document suggested that they note that he, quote, took his rifle to the scene of the rioting to help defend small business owners. The talking points also say, quote, Kyle was seen being chased and attacked by rioters before allegedly shooting three of them, killing two, which is very close to what Trump himself had already said when he said that he was, quote, trying to get away from them. Them being the people that he killed after running from the first person that he killed. But Jason, what do you think about this? Is DHS apparently taking the side of the guy who had just murdered people?
Well, what do I think about this, John? I'm not surprised, one. Two, had this been a man of color, those talking points would have been in complete condemnation of that person. It would have read as he was a violent, vicious, evil person who went there to enact violence. You know how they make it sound like, yeah, it's like the promo of a Star Wars movie. Like, and it's for a national security agency to have those type of talking points, it's very indicative of the corruption. And I don't even know if that's even a good word, of the, I can't even articulate the word for what that is, but it's not good. And also how you have people that their jobs are hired to spin things in the media. And what does that say about them? Like, John, I don't think I could ever hold, and maybe because I've never had this position, but I don't think I could ever be at a place and have what happened in Kenosha. And me, my job is to make it look better for the American people or for the public when I know that that's not true. And there's people that are dead, especially in light of everything that's happening in our country. So to hear, yeah, this, it's very disheartening. It's very disappointing, but also it's not surprising. It's not surprising. And I stand by, had this been a person of color beyond black or just a not, it would have been a completely different story with a completely different talk track with completely different talking points.
100%. The question from my point of view, the only one, is was this directly from Trump? It didn't have, right, to be, because while Trump obviously wants this killer, this terrorist to be defended, there's probably any number of people working in the US government right now that are sympathetic to what
there's
happened.
That finger again. So, there's that finger.
Oh my God. Oh God. Yeah, I got a finger for him. But anyway, let me give you a little bit more information from this reporting from NBC News. Four former Homeland Security officials, two of whom worked for Republican administrations, said it was unusual for law enforcement officials to be instructed to weigh in on a case involving a particular group or individual before investigations had concluded. With one individual, Elizabeth Newman, who worked as DHS's Assistant Secretary for Threat Prevention and Security Policy in the Trump administration, saying, "What strikes me about the talking points is that they didn't call for calm among the public. Even in the early hours after the incident, it was known private militias had self-deployed. They seemed more interested in Rittenhouse's reputation than calling for calm and actual law and order." Well, isn't that weird that they would, right, be more interested in his reputation? Is there anyone else who was doing the same sort of thing? Yes, in the hours after those killings, Fox News leapt to his defense with Tucker Carlson saying that, oh, what a sad situation that kids are forced to do this, implying that the kid was doing the right thing. They were all managing his reputation because they do support it, and they support more people going to these protests and doing the same sort of thing. So now you have the militia, you have the right-wing media, and you also have the people in charge of keeping us safe working to do PR for the people who are literally trying to kill us in the streets.
And that's where we're at, John. You can't shroud that in any kind of other thought process. You really can't. That's the truth. That is the truth. You know what's so frustrating when you read these things and you hear these things and you see these things? It's like it makes you second guess. And is this real life? Like, is the Department of Homeland Security doing this? Is this real, or am I missing? You're gaslighting. You start gaslighting yourself, right? Because there is no way that what is happening is not happening, right? What you just said is exactly what's happening. These people, the right-wing media, and as you said, entities that have been put in place to protect us as American citizens are all in bed together trying to protect this monster. And so, and it's the truth, but yet, what's even more mind-blowing and unconscionable is that people want to argue that when the proof is in the pudding and the facts are right there. You know, yeah, it's and then so you get mad at yourself because you're like, well, maybe I'm crazy. No.
Yes.
No. You're not crazy. Yeah. This is reality. The point I'm trying to make is just that we're all screwed. If again, the people that are put in place, as you said, to protect us and to have our best interests, whatever that means to them or whatever that is, can't do that anymore or have no interest in doing that, then what's next? Another civil war? You know?
We had Michael Shore, who works for 2IT, yeah, or works with 2IT. He did an interview right after the debate, and a Trump supporter was talking about how if the election's stolen from Trump, which means if Trump loses, because they've been, yes, trained to believe that, right, that he wants a civil war.
How extreme is that?
It's insane. It's insane. But no, Antifa, they're the trouble. Yeah, and it's another, like, Biden's got to win, because at the very least, he'll clear out the top 10% of the DHS and the top 10% of the FBI. They get to make those appointments. And hopefully, while I will probably disagree with those appointments in any number of different ways, I will at least be fairly certain that those people won't be sympathetic towards militia members committing terror attacks inside of the US. And I can't feel that way right now. I can't be sure of that.
Yeah, and how do we, but you know, as you said earlier, how do we make sure that Biden wins? We have to get out and vote. That it's when you dumb it down, people have to vote. And again, the conversation is, why are people so, like, just so staunch and everyone voting? Well, it's stuff like this. It's this all encompassing dumpster fire that is our current administration.
I agree. TYT.com/vote, vote.org to get the information to vote. If you've already voted, track to make sure that it actually got where it needs to go. If you can vote early in person, do so safely to help mitigate some of the red mirage that is coming, and join us on election day for our coverage. But understand that it is likely not going to be a one-day event. It is going to be a week-long event, and that is okay if that's what democracy takes.
Yes.
The worst thing is not it taking a few extra days. The worst thing is the vote not counting. Right now, Donald Trump and the Republicans are working to push Amy Coney Barrett onto the Supreme Court as fast as possible, preferably before the election, because of the election and Trump's repeated stated desire to have as many Republican judges on the court as possible in case something needs to be done. And the important thing that you need to know is that she did not commit to recusing herself from cases related to the outcome of the 2020 presidential election. According to her written responses to the Senate Judiciary Committee questionnaire of all of the possible recusing that she might do, there were things that she said she would recuse herself from, to be fair. Any case involving her husband or her sister, both of whom are attorneys. She would also recuse herself from cases that involve Notre Dame University as a party. She was a law professor there since 2002. Right. She also said that she would recuse herself from any matters having to do with her current role as a judge on the US Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. But on election related matters, she is saying, no, if Trump puts me on the court and then something happens where I have to decide the state of the election or whose vote is going to count and all of that, I am not committing myself to recusing from that. I'm not surprised by this, because I don't think that she'd be the nominee if she wasn't willing to protect Donald Trump, Jason. But I think everyone who wants a smooth democratic transfer of power should be very worried about this move.
100%. And the fact that, well, one, she triggers me. I'm so triggered by her. She reminds me of my third grade teacher that was just a nightmare. She is a brilliant attorney. Christian, has this very evangelical. And I, to your point, I agree. Trump is giving her an alley-oop, a leg up, saying, hey, listen, I'm gonna go hard for you to get the highest court in the land, your whole legacy in your life. This is what you work for. You are going to be the Beyonce of the Supreme Court justice. But I need loyalty. It's much like Roger Ailes, and you watched that movie. I brought a bombshell earlier when we were talking about Megyn Kelly, about how he demanded loyalty from people he helped and put in very powerful and very advantageous and lucrative and successful positions. This is that to me. Of course, this is all speculative and alleged in my own mind. But yeah, Donald Trump's nominating her. and putting and giving her the job of a lifetime, and that does come with strings. That absolutely comes with strings attached. So what? Yeah, she'll recuse herself from her from family matters, from Notre Dame. That stuff won't have the amount of long lasting for her to talk about those things. If she didn't, those things will not have the long lasting results as if she went on and said something bad about Donald Trump or didn't recuse herself. You know, it's like that'll impact her a lot longer than anything she would say about her family or Notre Dame, right? Yeah. So of course she's not going to do that. And this is all unspoken, but just listening to the way she's talked about the law and who she is and what she stands for in her foundation, she's a scary individual. That and she has 7 kids. She's probably tired and not thinking straight. So I'm not surprised by this. Nothing that we have talked about today on the damage report has been surprising in any shape, way, or form or capacity, John. And this is just adding that to the list.
I gotta come up with something then. You know, I bring you on to blow your mind, and apparently I've lost my touch. I just can't do it anymore.
No. The fantasy novel that was the scoop of the year. That was fresh off the press, breaking news headline. John Adarola, fantasy novel, Stephen King. Here we come.
Kayleigh McEnany is a liar, and she's often quite pathetic. But I have a lie for you from her that is so pathetic that I am worried that I'm being trolled by this. So what's the lie? It has to do with Amy Coney Barrett and her qualifications to get onto the Supreme Court. So Kayleigh McEnany said to the press that Amy Coney Barrett is not just, you know, an academic, as we know that she is, and a long-serving law professor and respected and all of that. No, in addition, she is a Rhodes Scholar. Now, if you're not familiar with the Rhodes Scholarship, it's an international program that allows people to go and study at the University of Oxford. It's very prestigious.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be shocked to find out that she is not a Rhodes Scholar. She got a degree from Rhodes University. Memphis, which is not the same thing. And she was called on that by the press today. Take a look.
I had a question about unemployment, but I first wanted to clean up something from your opening. You said Judge Barrett was a Rhodes Scholar. I'm not sure that that's true.
She attended Rhodes College.
So
my bad.
Very different thing. All right. Yeah, my bad. You know.
My bad. Well, look, I'll give it to first. I love her use of my bad. She gets points for that. This goes back to who is in the room prepping these people. And I always love that reporter in the press room that always talks like that's probably some nerdy kid from Sandusky, Ohio. That's like, you know, just real quick, you said she would like that. Just that was the highlight of the last decade for him, was getting that one little morsel. And he had to muster up the confidence to ask that question, because he knew if he didn't, he couldn't go back home and look at himself in the mirror. But it was the best question ever. Kudos to him as well. But I saw this, Sean. And as someone who works in television and works in news, our job, especially as journalists, is to be as factual and to vet and to really do our research before we even think about going on air, right? Or we think about talking about anything. And the fact that her job is to do that and she failed is beyond me. And normally she does an okay job lying to the American people. She does an okay job. It's okay. She knows she's pretty good at being White House Barbie. But this was like, what happened? Like, really? You had one job. One job.
No offense to people who got a degree from Rhodes University. I went to the University of Connecticut, man. Okay, I'm not throwing any stones. I'm just saying, arguably not as prestigious as the Rhodes Scholarship.
Right.
You know, either of her degree or my degree, either of them, not as prestigious. I'm just going to put that out there. And I have to say that, you know, I laugh as like a defense mechanism, but like she really should have gotten that right. And I don't know going forward how I can trust her when, you know, on her first day she said this.
Also, will you pledge never to lie to us from that podium?
I will never lie to you. You have my word on that.
But the Rhodes thing, but you said you wouldn't. I don't, what am I supposed to think? The world has just turned upside down on me. Is she actually a liar?
That was in her notes, though. That was in her notes. Well, who wrote those notes, Kaylee? Like,
who wrote them?
Who
right. wrote so, them?
There
would dare go into your Trapper Keeper, okay? Right. Only you.
Trapper Keeper, oh wow. I loved my Trapper Keeper. I had 5. Someone stole one, but I love John.
I miss them. Save. I miss them. You could probably still get them.
And the Velcro was like, man, that Velcro lasted a lifetime. That Velcro was strong from start to finish. But there was probably some intern or whomever. I would love to know what goes on in the rooms at the White House when they prepare for any kind of press conference, any kind of public speaking event. There's probably like a whole stable of interns that are just scrambling everywhere, getting coffee, writing down inaccurate information on post-its, you know, just getting to earning that hard taxpayer money to make sure that White House Barbie sounds like an idiot. That was a horrible, horrible move. But hey, again, not shocked. Welcome to 2020 and the administration that is Trump.
Yeah. I really thought that I was gonna get you with that one.
Thank you. That was really good, John. You're getting there. That's on a scale of 1 to 10. That was an 8.5.
Oh, okay. Well, you know what? I'm gonna go out on a high note. Okay. I think that's pretty good. Jason, thank you so much. It's the light of our week when you're on. I know that you're doing a lot these days. Where can people follow your work?
John, thank you for having me. Always a pleasure, always an honor to share this time with you. You can follow me on social media on Instagram at Jason Carter Official. Tune into Jason Unleashed Monday through Friday. Also, you can check me out on Twitter at JJC Forever, not forever, forever the word. I'm always tweeting out some crazy stuff there. And again, always a pleasure to hang out with you on the Damage Report and TYT Army for life here. I'm so blessed and so honored to be here.
Thank you so much. Have a good one. It doesn't seem like in 2020 public education is in a particularly good place. Whether you're, you know, a family who is wondering when or if your kids will even be able to go back to school, whether it will be safe if they do that, or if you're just worried about the federal government's approach to public education over the past few years, you probably have more than a few concerns, which is why I am very glad to welcome to the show the author of Schoolhouse Burning: Public Education and the Assault on American Democracy, author and professor at the University of South Carolina Law School, Derek Black. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Glad to talk about this. This is an important topic. So tell me a little bit about, I know that we're going to go into some of the history too, but how would you rate the current status of public education and the government's approach to it?
Well, I mean, it's really a tale of two different worlds. I mean, we have a lot of, you know, relatively well-financed school districts and communities out there that, you know, they can care for their kids at home, or they've got, you know, new buildings and lots of space outside so that they can accommodate, you know, sort of in person. And then we have these other group of kids who don't have good access to internet, you know, encountering a lot of problems, sort of economic and otherwise, and their schools are underfunded and have enormous skyrocketing costs to buy PPE, retrofit the buildings. And so we really just have two entirely different situations. You know, that's not really new at all. It's just that the pandemic has accentuated the problem.
Well, I know that there has been, discussion about what the obligation of the federal government should be to provide additional funding, you know, both for the context of 2020, but specifically, for instance, for things like PPE. So far, how would you rate the level of resources that have been committed by the federal government to make reopening the schools and all of that as easy and safe as possible, especially for, as you point out, the school districts that don't necessarily have the property tax base that they'll have the resources they need if the government doesn't provide them?
I mean, it's been a pretty abysmal response. If you compare how much money Congress gave public schools during the Great Recession versus how much they just gave them for the pandemic, I mean, we're talking about a fraction of the dollars this time. And to be clear, you know, during the Great Recession, it wasn't that costs were skyrocketing, it's just that local tax base was plummeting. Now what we have is local tax base plummeting and costs going up, and Congress only allocating, you know, a quarter on the dollar compared to what it did last time. So, you know, a lot of our school districts are in a really bad situation, having to think about lay off cleaning staff, lay off teachers. It is dismal in a lot of our communities. And I think a lot of those families are really worried about their children falling behind in a way that they'll never catch up.
So, you know, in your look back at the status of public education, how I believe you describe it as an erosion over time of its place in America. Was there a time where things were significantly better that we didn't see the sort of pattern that you're talking about right now? And how far back do we have to go to get to that time?
Well, as I always say, America started out with a great idea and it's been reaching to try to achieve it ever since its founding. So there is no sort of great old days in which our public schools were integrated and fully funded. I would never make that claim. But what we do have are good old days, so to speak, when leaders of both parties were committed to the idea of public education. And that's what has really changed in the last, 5 to 10 years, that we have a 200-year-plus history where we have our leaders and our country committed to the expansion of education because they say public education is the foundation of our democracy. Mm-hmm. It is the thing that we all need that will guarantee the preservation of all of our other rights. But now we're in a situation where we have a president calling them government schools in a pejorative sense, the Secretary of Education calling them a dead end, and the president and his platform saying that his goal is to provide private school choice to every single child in America. So we have one, and I'm not trying to make it political, this is just the facts. We have one party that for the first time in history is completely arrayed against the idea of public education. So we are in a new bad era that we have never seen before on that.
So the privatization that you're talking about there, the charter schools and all of that, it was pretty clear when Betsy DeVos was chosen that it's that she wasn't being brought in to, bring public education back to where it needs to be. And so I guess you've already sort of alluded to your views on her in that role. As a complete non-expert, she seems like a disaster for public education. But what do you think about Betsy DeVos in particular? What effect has she had in the years that she's been, in US government?
I mean, she's been more effective than I thought she would. I've been involved in federal policy and testified as an expert before. And when she first took the job, I said, the fact that she's taking the job shows how little she knows. Because if she really understood the lack of power that this job currently has, she wouldn't want it. So I thought, well, she'll just be a sideshow. Congress really reined in the Secretary of Education following the Duncan years because he had overreached. But she took the job, and what's amazed me is how much influence she has asserted, and it's partly because of how brazen she is, that she doesn't care what the law says. She doesn't care what American public wants or needs. I mean, I think even Congress got caught off guard. She's been in office for 3 years. Congress passes a Coronavirus Act, sending out, although not enough, sending out several hundred millions to our school. And we're thinking, you know what? She'll put privatization aside, at least for a little while, given that we're in a national pandemic. She'll let that agenda go. But as soon as the checks arrived at the Department of Education, she was already talking about how she could exploit the pandemic for her private school agenda. And she lost 3 or 4 cases in about as many weeks recently. And a Trump appointed judge even said, in regard to her new policies trying to drive more money to private schools, the Trump appointed judge said, the law cannot mean the opposite of what it says. Now, the idea that a federal judge would have to say that to a federal official is quite shocking. And so, she just caught us all off guard with her brazen attempts. I mean, for the younger listeners out there and folks that have got student loans, she was basically held in a contempt of court because she insisted on continuing to try to collect student loan debt when the law said those students didn't owe it. I mean, that's outside of the K-12 context, but the law, she thinks, obviously doesn't apply to her.
Yeah, it's just amazing. I agree, she's been very effective. Is she emblematic of a enduring change in the Republican Party's approach to education, do you think? Or hypothetically, if Trump were to lose and someday some other Republican were to run, is this like the new default position of the Republican Party, that charter schools privatization is the way to go? Or will we get back to two parties that might disagree on the level of resources that should go to public schools, but that they both sort of at least fundamentally agree that they serve a purpose and should exist?
Well, it's difficult to sort of predict the future for obvious reasons, but I think what we see is a party that has continually been captured by fringe ideas. Not because Republican voters on the whole believe in those ideas, but because the big money donors believe in those ideas, and maybe a majority of the people who show up at a primary believe in those ideas. So, you know, I mean, it's not news to say Donald Trump doesn't really represent the values of the Republican Party on a number of policies, but man, he sure is popular. And I think the same thing on the privatization and the vouchers, that the sort of libertarian wing, the sort of anti-tax wing of the party, the sort of Tea Party wing of the party, you know, they believe that in the same way at the federal level, you know, Social Security and healthcare are extractions of wealth from rich people, they say the same thing about public education at the local level, which is, I came from very humble beginnings, and that, you know, hey, Derek Black basically extracted wealth from his neighbor so that he could get a public education. If you look at state and local resources, the overwhelming majority of them are spent on public education. So it is, you know, public enemy number one for that wing of the Republican Party. And so I guess to answer your question, it depends on whether the party itself is going to be a big tent party and begin to reorganize itself around common values, or it's going to continue to be dominated by this sort of small fringe element. And right now, it's being dominated by a small fringe element.
Is there on the other side some sort of countervailing movement, either at the federal level or in individual states, to strike against this seemingly endless, you know, movement towards more privatization, more funding to charter schools and things like that? Is there anything to balance that out?
Well, there has been in the last couple of years, and it's been very encouraging. So a lot of people would say, oh, you know, Derek Black, he's frothing at the mouth liberal and you know, tool of the unions or something like that. But when you look at 2018 and 2019, you saw tens of thousands of people in the streets marching on state capitals in red states, not in New York, you know, not in California. It started in the hills of West Virginia, a state that voted for Donald Trump at 75%. And then it moved to Oklahoma, a place with similar numbers. And then it moved to Arizona. 50,000 people marched on the Capitol of Arizona demanding for the full funding of public education. And 65% plus of voters voted against vouchers in Arizona, right? And you know, here in South Carolina, we had the largest public protest on our state capitol grounds in decades. It was flowing over into the streets here. And so, you know, I think what we see is that small fringe element has been, you know, gaining steam for a while, and we kind of ignored them, but they finally pushed so far that regular folks who don't want to politicize education, regular folks said, I have got to take to the streets. And so, you know, that gives me a lot of hope, but you know, we got to keep fighting because the people on the other side are just as determined and more well financed, to be quite honest. So I think that, you know, the public education advocates have got to fight.
Yeah, it's not hard to imagine why that push towards more federal money going to charter schools would receive a lot of financial support in that movement. Everyone should definitely take a look at the book Schoolhouse Burning, Public Education and the Assault on American Democracy. Derek Black, we really appreciate you joining us on the show today and lending your expertise.
Thanks, appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.